in school, kids hear you're lazy, you're not trying hard enough, you just have to try harder. And that is, I think, my biggest pet peeve, because dyslexic kids try harder than everybody and anybody in that classroom. If you have two kids sitting there and one is dyslexic and one is not, and one is getting A's and one is getting C's, that child is trying very hard for their C's.
Are you raising your family while also feeling like you're still growing up yourself? Do you wonder if you are getting it right? Welcome to Growing Up with Dr. Sarah. She's a pediatrician and a mom, and she helps the whole family.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sarah Adams, a board-certified pediatrician, but I'm not your pediatrician. Feel free to use my podcast as helpful information, but in no way do I intend my podcast to replace the advice of your physician. Your physician knows you and is in the best position to provide medical advice. Welcome back. I'm Dr. Sarah, and today we're talking about something that affects 1 in 5 people in this country. Yet the vast majority have never received a formal diagnosis or the support they deserve. Dyslexia is the most common neurocognitive disorder in the United States. Over 40 million adults are estimated to have it. But here's the number that stops me in my tracks. Only 2 million of them have ever been formally diagnosed. That's a staggering gap, and it has real consequences for kids in our classrooms, in our exam rooms, and in our families. My guest today knows the story from the inside. Dr. Lisa Rappaport was diagnosed with dyslexia as a child. She went on to earn her PhD, build a career as a professor, and work as a clinical practitioner. Welcome, Lisa. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Lisa, I know you've dedicated your work to helping others understand how a person with dyslexia learns and can thrive. And you've brought all of that, your research, your clinical experience, your personal story, into a book that I think every parent, teacher, and pediatrician should have at arm's reach. Can you take us back to when you were diagnosed? What was that moment like for you and your family? And how did it change, for better or worse, the way people saw you?
So the diagnosis came when I was 6. So it wasn't a big aha moment for me. However, I did know I was struggling. I just couldn't articulate it. And from there, with the diagnosis, no one knew how to help me. So I started with tutors and I started with all kinds of interventions. But truly, my mother is the one that taught me how to read. And I struggled through lower school and middle school, but where it really hit home was high school. Because as we know now, dyslexic children process things slower. They need extended time. I didn't have, there were no interventions back then, such as extended time. There were no accommodations. And so it was in high school where I actually started to flunk out. And I actually, in junior year, was flunking out of high school. So that's when the diagnosis was quite significant for me and it affected my life. And I actually thought about quitting high school at a certain point.
Oh, and that's really hard. And I know you're not alone. I've had patients in my practice who felt the same way. Can you talk more about your mom and how she was a strong support for you?
So my mom really understood that I was smart. She would talk to me and I was very verbal. So our discussions from the time I was little were very intricate and insightful, but I couldn't read. And she realized there was a gap. So she would actually read to me. And then once she read to me, I could understand the material and I could spit it back at school. But straight through senior year, she read to me. Senior year was the first year I started to read my own homework to myself. So she was pivotal. I dedicated my book to her because she was the reason I learned how to read. And she was also the person when the reason I thought of quitting high school is because my dean called me into her office and said, you're either not trying or you're stupid. Which is it? And that was the day I came home from school after struggling already and saying, you know, I really, this is it. And we'd had so many fights about school up to that point that my mom at that point said, you're 16, you can quit. And so it was on my own volition that I went back the next week and started, you know, to try again. But she was the reason I got a degree. And she just understood and persevered because she knew in her heart that I was smart enough and I could do it. And I just learned differently.
And look at you now. You've gone on to earn a PhD and become a professor and a clinician. How did you feel in class when you knew your brain was processing different than other students? What did you need at that moment?
I needed understanding what I felt was shame, which is why I wrote the book, because I think I've interviewed a lot of people who are dyslexic, a lot of adults, and they still carry shame. And it's something that really doesn't go away. And I will say that I started the notes for this book when I was in graduate school. And when I got the job that I have now, I didn't want anyone to know I was dyslexic. And so I sat on the book for 25 years because I was still ashamed and still thought they would think differently of me if they knew I had a diagnosis. And I just want to change that.
When was the turning point then where dyslexia stopped feeling like a barrier and really started feeling like an opportunity, especially to help others?
Well, I always knew I wanted to help others. It was that pivotal moment in high school when I decided not to quit, that I decided that I would grow up and become an advocate for kids like myself. So I've done this my whole life because I've always wanted to help other people with dyslexia. And I think through talking to all of these accomplished people who were dyslexic, and when you talk, as you said, it's one in five. So when you speak to someone and you say, I'm dyslexic, or I'm writing about a book about dyslexia, they will often say, if they're not dyslexic, someone they know is.
Yes.
And so you start to realize it's really pervasive and it's just different. It's not anything but a difference. And if you're taught correctly, you can do anything and achieve anything. And that's when the shame starts to go away, when you realize you're in such good company.
Absolutely. Before we go any further, let's make sure everyone listening is working from the same definition. In plain non-technical terms, which I love about your book, by the way, what is dyslexia and what is it not?
So it really is a language processing disorder. Okay. And it can affect spoken language. It can affect written language. It certainly affects reading comprehension because there's no automaticity, or there's very little automaticity when you're learning how to read. And if you can't read the words automatically, you can't start to understand what you've just read because you've struggled so hard to read the actual word that the paragraph doesn't make sense because you've just gotten through it so slowly. It can affect spelling and math. And I think something that people don't realize, it affects organization, temporal organization and sequencing skills, which is really time management and organization. And that's a really big part of it. And that's an area where parents can help children, even if they don't know how to teach someone to read. Nobody, it's a science, but you can certainly help your kids and support them in other ways. And organization is a big one.
I hear what you're saying. And I noticed in my practice that it also is not a one-size-fits-all diagnosis that there, as you so eloquently defined for us, there's so many elements, and it's very complicating. And what I struggle with is that there's so many myths floating around about dyslexia, what parents hear, what the kids are told. What are the ones you find yourself needing to correct most often?
So the big one is that dyslexic people are not as intelligent as others, because they certainly are. And another one is lazy. A lot of in school, kids hear you're lazy, you're not trying hard enough, you just have to try harder. And that is, I think, my biggest pet peeve, because dyslexic kids try harder than everybody and anybody in that classroom. If you have two kids sitting there and one is dyslexic and one is not, and one is getting A's and one is getting C's, that child is trying very hard for their C's. The other one is that you'll outgrow it, because you don't. Even with remediation, you're always going to have remnants of being dyslexic. I still have areas that it affects every single day. And the other one is that dyslexic people don't like to read, because they do. And I think the other question I get is, well, what area should a dyslexic person look at professionally? Well, as you said, it's a spectrum, and it affects people very differently. So a dyslexic person can be anything and do anything that interests them. There's nothing that's a rule out or a rule in just because you have this diagnosis.
If you're looking for more information or clarity as you're navigating today's topic, check out our description box below where we'll share resources to help guide you through these moments. And please like and share this episode with others so they can access this useful conversation as well. Also, subscribe to our YouTube channel so you can get those two new episodes each month. Dr. Lisa, when you tell me that story about how kids are often identified as being lazy, that really hits me hard. I know even my own son struggled with that. And I remember one of the teachers would just say his head is in the clouds. And when I discovered that really reading for him was like reading a foreign language, it really made a difference. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you a question on the note of reading, you know, the thought of reading. Tell me, what about options of listening to audiobooks? Is that something you recommend for those with dyslexia?
Absolutely. I think it's a fantastic intervention. As I said, my mother read to me because it's the best way to get through and it's the best way to understand. The one thing I would say is if your child is listening to an audible book, to have them read along, because they should read along. It will help.
That sounds like it would make a big difference to listen and read along, and they get the benefits of both the internal, like the external processing, but also being able to read along as they go. So thank you for sharing that. You know, that statistic I brought up about 40 million are estimated to have dyslexia, but only 2 million are diagnosed dyslexic. That gap is really alarming. From your clinical experience, why is there such a gap? And what's the cost to go undiagnosed for years or even decades?
It's a huge cost to society, and it's a huge cost to any individual. And I really think education is the problem. And as you said, I think we should start with our pediatricians. I was hoping that every pediatrician could read my book or have it in their office, because I think that there is a lack of understanding and knowledge. And a lot of times parents will say to me, well, I knew my child was struggling, but he was only 6 or 7. And so the pediatrician said, just wait. Or the school said, just wait. And that's the worst thing you can do. You want early intervention as early as possible. And there are things you can do as a parent before a child even starts school to get them ready to learn to read. So I think it's
absolutely. I would agree 100%, especially speaking as a pediatrician, that this is a book, and I said it in the beginning and I meant it, every parent and every pediatrician definitely should have it on hand. I really wish I did earlier in my career, for sure. And it again, I want to emphasize that we're talking about a learning difference, not a deficit. And as a pediatrician, I'm often the first person a parent brings their concerns to. What are the early signs? And you mentioned like it's important to be diagnosed early, especially before second grade. What should make a teacher or a parent say, we need to look into this closer?
When you have a little guy and you're playing with them, if they're having trouble articulating words, that's a soft sign. We call them soft signs because there's not just one specific thing. But if they have trouble repeating difficult words, if they have trouble learning their left and right, when they come home from even like kindergarten or preschool and you say to them, or even a day at the playground and you say, well, let's go through what we did today. And they have trouble sequencing and saying what they did first, second, third, those are little signs. Those are the sequencing signs I was talking about. And that's where you can start to just get an idea. There are also games, parents don't know this to do this, but if you say to a child, let's talk about the word bat, what color, what sound comes first? Can you isolate the sound of the word bat? It starts with a ba, now you say it. If they have trouble isolating sounds, that's another clue. If they have trouble rhyming, that's another clue. So there are little soft signs before they're even taught to read that where you can start to get an idea. If they have trouble with the months, learning the months of the year or the days of the week, that's another sign.
So yes, those are great thoughts. And I think really important too. So let's think about that parent who just got the call from school saying their child might have dyslexia. What do you want those parents to hear first? What do you want them to do first?
Don't panic.
Okay.
Okay. Realize.
Good advice.
The first question I get is, will my child go to college? Yes.
Yes.
You know, it depends where you are and what your resources are. But the first thing to do is have an evaluation. And everybody has the right to a free evaluation through the public school system. You can also have it done privately. But everybody has the right to an evaluation. And that's the first thing you should do. You want to know your child's strengths, their weaknesses, what's going on, and where you should shore up some of those weaknesses. And as I said, some of the games I was just talking about, you can do in the bath with your child. And you're teaching them and you're remediating them, but they don't realize it. And it's a fun way to interact with your child.
You know, it makes me wonder that, you know, I have found a battle sometimes, and I'm not putting down the educational system at all, but there'll be times where I'll be talking to a family and I know that they need to be tested or screened and learn more about next steps. And then they go to the school and then the school tells them to come back to me. So where can they go to get their kids screened or learn more about next step if the school comes back and says, we can't do this, even though you just said they have a right to?
I mean, I say in the book, you have to be a tiger mom or dad. You just can't say no for an answer, because the schools do have financial reasons to not test your child. And so if your child's not that severe, they're not going to want to do it. But you've got to advocate for your child and you've got to insist and don't let go.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree. I love that metaphor of being the tiger mom. It is important. And sometimes too, I have found that if your school district doesn't have the resources to do it, it's really up to the school, if I'm correct, Lisa, that they're responsible to finding the resources, maybe possibly in another school district, and allowing that child to be able to gain that screen if needed.
Correct. And there are also attorneys, if you have to go that way, that specialize in this.
My niece had to get involved with that, and we don't want it to get that way. So just realize, focusing on the child as a parent, just saying, I'm not trying to make waves. I just want to do what's best for my kid. I know you as an educational system want the same thing. And you bring up a really good point, and that is about those kids who maybe have that school itself doesn't see it as a significant problem. I found, at least with my own kids, it was either one extreme or the other, but those middle kids are the ones that really get lost. And sometimes dyslexia can really be hard to diagnose in those kids that are continuing to function pretty well, but they just can't catch up.
And they also learn to mask it. Mm-hmm. So through sometimes till fourth or fifth grade, and no one realizes what's going on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I read an interesting statistic recently where girls are diagnosed 2 to 3 times less often than boys, even though researchers think that the true prevalence is actually similar. What do you think is driving that? What are we missing when we don't catch girls early?
Well, what are we missing? We're missing an opportunity to educate half of our population. So, you know, and again, the shame is so pervasive, and the depression and the feeling that you're less than, or you can't work, or you can't do what you're supposed, what, you know, live up to your expectations. It's really, it's so sad. It's such a shame. You know, I mean, again, personally, when I graduated, I finally got myself to an Ivy League school, which was my dream. But when I graduated, the only thing I really thought I wanted to do was to manage a gym, because I didn't feel like I could do anything else. Mm-hmm. Even after getting through school, I just thought, you know, this is where I'm going to stop. I don't want to push. Yeah. So the shame goes on, and it's just really important to catch it early and use some workarounds to avoid that shame, find strengths.
Do you think masking symptoms or that shame effect, if it affects young girls more than young boys, or is it about even?
I think it's even. I think anyone who sits in a classroom and knows they are not learning feels awful and tries to hide it.
Absolutely.
So I just think, I don't know why girls are not picked up as often, maybe because boys might misbehave. Because I always said when I get a call that that a little boy has been told, or a little girl, that they're ADD or ADHD and they're really young, I always rule out dyslexia, because a lot of times a child might look, especially a boy, they'd rather look like they're rambunctious, or they might just be so bored because they're not understanding or getting the information, they can't keep up, than look stupid. So they may actually try to be the naughty kid or the class clown. And that's maybe how a boy will do it, where a girl might just become quiet. And so I think that might be why boys are picked up sooner.
I think that's brilliant, actually, Dr. Lisa. I can absolutely 100% see how that could be the case. And often, again, ADHD, we think of that right off the bat, even when especially when they're very young. And I love that you pointed out that we have to consider dyslexia as a possibility in those younger ages and as they continue to grow. The other thing that really alarmed me too is higher diagnostic rates among Black children and lower income families in recent data. What do you think those numbers tell us about who gets help and who gets missed?
I think it's a socioeconomic problem as well, because if you're in a school without resources, they don't want to pick you up and they don't want to identify you, because then they have to give you services. So it really comes down to finances in a lot of these districts. And again, I think a lot of the teachers are not educated. Just because you're a teacher doesn't mean you know anything about a learning difference. So I don't think a lot of them pick it up. And again, will they just say, well, he's lazy, he's not trying? You hear that all the time. It's his fault. Or her fault. So, and I think that's pervasive in these schools that may have less financial stability for support. And if they don't have the interventions available, they certainly don't want to identify the child, because then they are on the hook to pay for a private school or to send a child to a different district to give them the support they need.
So what I hear you saying is you got to trust your instinct as a parent, like much like your mom did.
So I always say the mom always knows. When a mom calls me and she says, the school doesn't think there's anything wrong, but I always say the mom knows. Moms know. Moms don't want there to be a problem with their child. They're not going to make something up just because they're bored at home. Like, they want their child to learn. They don't want an issue with their child. So if a mom says, I think there's a problem, there's probably a problem.
Yeah, that's a great way to frame it. So if you could change one thing, like one policy, one practice, one conversation to really close that diagnostic gap, what would it be?
If I could change one thing, it would be that every school uses the science of reading to teach reading. Because then from the get-go, you're teaching all of the children correctly. Everybody benefits. So if I could change one thing, that would be the thing I would change. Of course, if I could do anything, I would love every child to be screened. There is a screener that's very quick. It's 20 minutes. It's easy to do. You have to be trained. It's called Search and Teach by Rosa Hagen and Archie Silver. And again, it talks about the prerequisite skills that a child needs to know before they can learn to read. It's the skills I was talking about earlier. And if every child was screened, you could start to develop those skills in a child before they are even taught to learn to read, and reading will become easier.
That is such great advice. I'll tell you, if there's one thing I feel like I learned from COVID, and I'm not an educator or a psychologist like yourself, or a clinician in that area, but what I have learned is that every child learns differently, no matter who the child is, and that when it comes to education, there isn't a one-size-fits-all. So I love the idea of really having every child be screened in a simple way, and then you identify those kids that maybe need more further screening. One of the things that, you know, keeps coming up in our conversation is the emotional piece, and your book is filled with advice on how a caregiver can support a child emotionally and academically at different stages throughout their education. But let's start with the emotional piece, because I think it's often the part families feel least equipped for. What are some things you suggest in the book to help a child avoid that shame and navigate the experience of feeling different from their peers?
The first thing I always like to say to a child is it's not always going to be this way. You know, these are not the years you're going to peak. These will be the tough years, but it won't always be this way. And you may not be a good reader now, or you may not be good at math right now, but it won't always be that way. You will be a good reader. You will learn math, and things will get different, and you will shine in school if you choose to go on in school. But these are the tough years, and it stinks, but that's a fact, but it doesn't mean it's forever. So that's one of the things I like to always tell children or adolescents. I have a whole list of them. I love to develop areas of strength. I try to remind parents, because when you get the diagnosis, the first thing you want to do is throw a lot of interventions at the child and tutors and this and that and the other thing. But you can't forget about developing their areas of strength to give them pride. So it can be in the arts, it can be music, it can be sports, whatever it is, you really have to give them an area where they shine and feel proud. I like to use humor, because if you can laugh at yourself, and if you laugh first, it's harder for people to laugh at you. So if you make a mistake and you can own it, or if you're embarrassed about something, a grade, whatever it is, and you can own it or laugh at yourself and be self-deprecating, I think it really helps. And also, when you have a really, really bad day and you come home and everything's gone wrong, if you can pivot the way the child sees it and just say, you know what, I think we're going to laugh about this one day, because think about how bad your day really was. To just see the humor in anything awful, for anybody in any area of their life, I think helps. So those are a few. I think it's really important for parents to share their own failures, because I think parents want to be role models, and they feel that the way to be the role model is to be the parent who succeeded or was perfect or didn't fail. Maybe that will motivate my child not to fail too. But I think just stepping out and saying, I failed a lot of math tests in my day also, or whatever you did, wherever you fell down, I think it's really important, and it makes you very real. And it also makes it easier for the child to come home and say, guess what? I just failed my spelling test. You know, I mean, and also when that happened in our own family, and my son, who was good at school, came home and failed the Spanish test. And I said, I am so glad. And he was stunned. And I said, I think it's really important that you learn to fail. And what's going to happen now? And he said, well, I don't know. What is going to happen now? And I said, I don't know. What do you think? And he said, I'm going to meet with the teacher. And I said, okay. And then what's going to happen? And he said, I don't know. And I said, because nothing's going to happen. You'll meet with the teacher, you'll learn what you didn't know, and you're going to move on. Nothing's going to happen. And that's the whole point of failure. You'll pivot, but you've learned a good lesson that nothing is going to happen. And you will wake up tomorrow and you will go to school and everything's fine. And one day you might start a company that fails. And guess what? You'll pivot and you'll be fine, because you've learned how to fail. So we talk a lot about that. In my practice, we talk a lot about gratitude. Because I think, again, when you come home and you've had the day that you think is the worst day ever, or you're having the worst year ever and you're feeling very sorry for yourself, if you can have gratitude for what you do have and realize how lucky you are, or what I like to do is have a really dyslexic middle schooler or high schooler work with a little child and teach them something, it gives you a very different perspective. So the book is full of
I love all that. Oh, I'm grateful for you sharing all of that. It's really beautiful. And I love that you mentioned the humor. And I love admitting as parents that we fail sometimes, that we fall down and that we struggle. And it just brings the humanism back into everything and helps kids realize, like, especially the analogy of, well, what do you think is going to happen? And opening that open-ended conversation up with the child is so important, and realizing that in the big picture, everything's going to be okay. I remember this one story about this child who was diagnosed and then was getting the resources that they have. And then they came back into the office and the parent looked at me with tears in their eyes. I didn't do anything. You know, I mean, this was all done through the resources, thankfully, at school and some other resources that we had for him. But she came back and she said, I have my child back. You know, we are so much more. That child is so much more than their diagnosis. And you've lived this from both sides as somebody with dyslexia and as a clinician who works with dyslexic patients. What do you understand about this condition that you just simply couldn't learn from a textbook?
I think it's the empathy. I really think it's the empathy, because you can sit and teach a child the same thing over and over and over, and they will get it. They might sit and they can get 3 or 10 math problems, and then all of a sudden on number 11, the disconnect happens again. And that's when the tutor, the parent, the professional will say, well, what's going on? But I will say, I get that. I totally understand that. You know, or when they'll say, well, for left and right, just use your fingers like this or like, and I'm like, that makes no sense to me. That's not an intervention that I would find helpful. Some people might, but I don't. So I think literally when we're making interventions for a child and they say that doesn't make sense, or that made sense for 10 of them, but now I'm all confused again. That's what I can bring to the table, because I can say to the parent, this makes total sense. Don't get frustrated. They really are trying. This is what happens. There is a disconnect, or, you know, whatever the problem is, I definitely see it from that perspective. Even if they've been taught it over and over and over again and then can't get it, I get that.
I think that's a very good perspective that people need to understand, and is so important, and is definitely part of the complicated diagnosis of dyslexia. What about those people who don't have dyslexia? What do you want them to know about the diagnosis?
I think what you said, it's a learning difference. It's not a deficit. And I know there are still the majority of people out there think that it means you're not as intelligent or as capable. And I don't know how to convey that. But that is what I want people to understand. Just because someone learns differently or may read really slowly and need extra time to think of a thought and spit it out properly, that is really frustrating when people just don't understand that and put them into a little box and make assumptions about their abilities or capabilities.
And I love that as a role model, you can show that you can go on to get a PhD, to be a clinician, to be a professor. And I want to just thank you so much, Dr. Lisa, because I know this conversation is going to mean a lot to families that are listening. We'll link your book and all the resources you shared into the show notes. Thank you so much for being on Growing Up with Dr. Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And until next time, I'm Dr. Sarah, and let's grow up together.
Produced by Autovita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.